What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Harold Kushner, author of When Good Things Happen to Bad People, and the new book, Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I attended a conference put on by a section of the Jewish Federations of North America last week, JEFNA in its acronym. That's the umbrella organization known for many years as United Jewish Appeal, the combined fundraising entity that conceives of itself as representing the American Jewish community. This particular conference was organized with the stated purpose of exploring ways to make significant changes in the way that Jewish federations do business. That's really what they do, the business of raising money. Since federations are now realizing their donor base is growing older and shrinking, and the generation of Jews who came of age in the new millennium isn't participating in Jewish communal life or giving money in anything like the proportions that earlier generations did. The official reason for this meeting was to explore new initiatives and approaches to Jewish education and engagement. Excellent goals for an organization that has raised funds for a select set of Jewish priorities historically. Those standard areas of appeal for federations have been Israel advocacy and investment, certain specific local causes like Jewish family and children's services, local refugee work, and some community relations, and, well, self-perpetuation, that is, supporting the infrastructure to raise more funds by having professional fundraisers employed at the federation. The most interesting thing about this conference on education and engagement, the first in what is supposed to be a national series of federation explorations of how they will change and transform to be more effective and relevant in coming years, was that there was very little emphasis on Jewish education. That is, the conference on education didn't really address education. There was a whole lot about engagement, which means finding ways to contact and attract people, but very, very little substantive about how we teach Judaism or why and how it's important to do so in meaningful ways. That surprised me, since I was presenting on education, but the majority of the innovative programs and people they emphasized, the vast majority in this mini-conference, talked about different ways to spend money, called allocations, and how certain groups were successful in attracting contacts and involvement among previously unconnected people. There was quite a lot about how the various organs of the federations were being somewhat rearranged, but there was almost nothing substantive or creative about Jewish education, you know, Torah, and what there was didn't seem to much interest the delegates. These were bright, educated, active people, volunteers and professionals, who commit a great deal of time to trying to build and improve Jewish community. But the language they understood best was sort of a cross between business school speak and nonprofit board self-congratulation, overlaid with a very light coating of soft-focused, non-controversial kind of Jewish ideas. Rebrand your current work in a unified theme. Make token social action efforts look very successful. Rearrange your recruitment of younger people to not ask for money quite so soon. Everyone officially agreed that we can no longer continue to do what's been done for decades, and everybody agreed there's a great need for serious, committed change, but almost no one had any idea that in order to make these changes, there would be a real need for something besides business as usual. That is, the Federation movement and its leaders seemed to think that a little bit of cosmetic change and a slight adjustment in staffing and outreach will reinvigorate a calcified, aging and slowly dying Jewish institutional world that the Federation represents. In my view, may only be my view, the Federation has a fatal disease that can only be cured by a major reorientation of priorities. The approach I saw at this conference was very much like treating this institutional cancer with aspirin. It can't hurt, but it sure won't help much either. If the Federation types I met in Los Angeles and the Jewish Federation of North America as an organization really want to reach the contemporary American Jewish world, they cannot possibly do so unless they stop putting their resources into the exact same places they always have. A Judaism that is vital, active, and engaged requires exciting, dynamic Jewish education, meaningful and musical prayer services, and a community committed to real practice and action. Not symbolic gestures or rearranging the chairs on the Jewish Titanic. Until the Federation movement realizes that and stops simply repackaging and rebranding the same old stuff, it will remain on a sharp slope towards collapse, which it continues not to be aware of. Play us in on this Super Bowl Sunday, the truly universal American holiday, when we are grateful the hype will soon be over and the game actually played. Here's an upbeat non-football theme of gratitude from cantor Aaron Ben-Susan from the Psalms, Tov Lehodot. It's good to give thanks to God.
Tov Lehodot, Lehodot Lashem, Ulezamel Shimcha Elyon. Tov Lehodot. להודות לשם ולזמן לשמך עליון להגיד בבוקר חסדך ואמונתך בלילות להגיד בבוקר חסדך ואמונתך בלילות ולהודות להודות לשם ולזמן לשמך עליון ולהודות להודות לשם ולזמן לשמך עליון.
That was cantor Aaron Ben-Susan singing Tov Lehodot. It's good to give thanks to God. When we return in a few moments on Two Jewish, Rabbi Harold Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and an important thinker, author, and teacher, will explain how he arrived at his new book, Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life. When we come back here on Two Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are so pleased to have back a wonderful past guest of Two Jewish, Rabbi Harold Kushner, best known as the author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. One of his 13 books, his newest, is called Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life. one of the really wonderful interpreters, not just of Jewish wisdom, but of human wisdom for our generation, and maybe even the last couple, and hopefully a few to come. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Sam. It's good to be in touch with somebody in Tucson again as the cold weather arrives in Boston, and I can't think of a nicer interlocutor than you.
You are so kind. So I read a lot about this book, and I'm curious. It sounds almost like you're making this a final book. Is that fair?
You know, I write every book assuming it'll be my last. What right do I have to assume that I have another book in me? But no, I'm 80 years old, going to be 81 shortly after my visit to Tucson this February. Things are harder than they used to be, and I don't know if I have another book in me. I wrote this book because I wanted to say everything that I wanted to say. The last page of the book, which is something unique, and I hope a lot of your listeners will get a hold of the book and read it, it's a love letter to a world that may or may not deserve it. And it's the most personal statement I've ever written, a summary of just how I feel about life, about the good and bad things that have happened to me. I wrote it on the assumption that I may never write anything publishable after this again. If I get an idea and my publishers like it and my strength holds out, I will be privileged to write a book again. But it's not something you can ever take for granted.
You know, I was thinking there's a really fascinating aspect to that concept of love. In Judaism, we talk about justice and duty and many things. The Ve'ahavta is about love. But often we don't focus so much on God's love. We kind of leave that to Christianity. Is that a fair assessment?
I'm afraid it is, and I think you're onto something. Yeah, we have left the idea of love to be co-opted by Christianity, when in fact it is immensely present in Judaism and is a very useful corrective. Part of what my book is all about is how my ideas have changed since I was growing up in Brooklyn and educated at the Jewish Theological Seminary. A concept of religion as command and obey. I grew up with people who were afraid of violating God's laws. And where is the faith and where is the joy and where is the sense of what religion ought to bring, the intimacy of God when you know you're doing His will? And I've been trying, not alone, thank goodness, but been trying to convey another aspect, that the what we perceive as the commands of God are as a way of deepening our life, bringing more meaning into our life. To take an issue that is probably more significant to conservative Jews than to non-Jews or even Reformed Jews, the kosher laws, the system of observing the dietary laws. I've heard all sorts of absolutely loony justifications for people who do it and for people who reject it, when I'm convinced the real reason is to take something as mundane as to having a sandwich and turn it into an appointment with God. Turn it into a moment of encountering God's grace, that the world produces food which is tasty and nourishing, and we are in a position to enjoy it. If you eat mindlessly, if you gulp down your food while watching the clock, if you have the TV on while you're eating, you miss out on the human aspect of eating. And you're almost like an ox at its manger. So I think I've been trying to teach in this book and in my 50 years as a rabbi in Massachusetts the idea of observance as intimacy with God rather than simply blind obedience.
It's a powerful concept, one that has existed in Judaism before but has not always been central. We'll continue this great discussion with Rabbi Harold Kushner when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves. The FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes: propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award in 2016, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18 at gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Harold Kushner, author of When Good Things Happen to Bad People and the new book, Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life, will be speaking this Saturday night, February 13th, at Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson. Call 327-4501 for tickets or go to www.tetucson.org to register. We have 9 months until we elect a new president of the United States. We continue our election year feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. Well, mark me down for voting surprised. While Hillary Clinton correctly claimed a very close victory over Bernie Sanders in Iowa, the delegate and caucus count was shockingly incredibly close. And the verdict, Clinton or Sanders taking the majority of it, wasn't clear until the wee hours. It still seems unlikely that Bernie Sanders will become the first Jewish nominee of a major party for president, and still less likely that he will actually become president, but he raised an incredible amount of money after the Iowa vote had him take 49.6% of the vote to Hillary Clinton's 49.8%. It was the closest caucus in Iowa history, and the delegates are apportioned according to the percentage won, so pretty much even. On to New Hampshire, where Sanders is considered a big favorite. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our Mivi 9, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
There is a very interesting, challenging movement going on in Israel called Breaking the Silence that I don't think our listeners know very much about.
So Breaking the Silence actually is soldiers who served at the IDF. Some of them, I don't know if most of them, were officers in the combat units at the IDF and decided to break the silence and to share, you know, their experience mainly in the Yehuda Veshomron.
In the Shtachim, yeah. in the West Bank.
Yeah. So some of them, and we know this, it's not a secret. We know that there is always, a bad apple.
Yeah.
how do you say it?
There, will we say it? Bad there's, apples in
yeah,
the bunch.
Yeah, there's always bad apples. IDF service in Israel is mandatory. You know, everyone going to the. There is no screening. We are not taking only the creme de la creme. You know, everyone goes.
Everybody
to the,
serves.
And although everyone goes through a very, you know, tough training, and there is a conduct of behavior, and, you know, I was in the IDF, of course. We are trained not just how to chas v'chalila fight, because it's Israeli defense forces. It's more defense than offense. But there is always a bad, you know, mikrim situations that when we are very sad for this situation. Well, unfortunate there is this kind of situations. But what else? So these soldiers deciding to share their experience, whether if it's a soldier that saw other soldier acting not nicely to a family that they were in their house in Shechem or Jenin or wherever, or if it's, you know, all kind of different. I don't know that we have time to.
Occupation is a difficult
circumstance. It's difficult. It's a difficult situation. But so their goal, this organization, their goal is to expose these stories not in Israel, outside of Israel, which cause a lot of damage. You know, there is an expression, if you have laundry, you make it, you know, dirty laundry.
Don't wash it in public.
Wash it at home, you know. Right. If you want to make a difference, act in Israel, whatever. Do something in Israel. But when you decide to go with these stories, with this dirty laundry, to nations, to countries, to people who already hate us anyway, so you just give them more weapon. So the question, first of all, I'm proud that I'm part of a nation who allow these voices to be heard, first of all, and it's important for me to say. But on the other hand, if you really want to make a difference, this is the effective way to do it. That's the question for, I would say, at least the last month in Israel. It's really one of the burning issues in Israel right now, which if breaking the silence is really to allow them to talk. Of course, they can talk, but is it a democracy, or is it on the very, a very delicate border of betraying your own country, your own people, who, you know, living on occupation from both sides? It's not, you know, it's not easy. So that's Breaking the Silent organization.
It's an interesting organization, and we'll probably continue this next week and talk about some of the ways Israelis perceive the occupation itself. Thanks so much, Ashrat.
Toda rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, the headmaster of Tucson Hebrew Academy. I think I change your title every time I introduce you.
head of school, technically, yes, yes, but I'll take headmaster.
Boker or. When students come into a public school, they usually start at kindergarten, first mm-hmm. grade, second grade, they tend to stay in the same schools throughout.
Right.
Children come in, students come into a day school, in some ways, similarly to the way they come into a supplementary Hebrew religious school.
Right.
At any time, they can enter in
yeah.
kindergarten, they can enter in second grade, fifth grade.
And they can come in the middle of the year. It definitely poses a challenge for programs, whether they're after school or full day school program. And the trick, as I imagine you know, and maybe our viewers may not know as much, is to find out what level the child is, and then you know, work the programming accordingly. So, for example, when someone's coming new into THA, we do an assessment. And this is true for Hebrew language ability, but also for general education, level of math, level of reading. And then the teachers are able to do what we call differentiation. So they're able to work with the child at their ability level and move them forward. So our program has different levels of students receiving instruction accordingly. So we have ability grouping and flexible groups so that if a child enters at a certain level and then masters that level's worth of curriculum, they're ready to level up and move forward.
Now, our experience, and I'm sure it's true for you guys too, is that it's not a matter of whether kids are bright. Or they may excel in public school, but if they come in and they don't know Aleph Bet, then obviously you have to teach them. We usually have a kind of a learning lab in which we move them ahead in language skills. The idea in Judaism is not that everybody's at the same level. It's that you reach people wherever they are.
Exactly. And you know, it's our philosophy as well. Our arms are open. We embrace everybody, regardless of affiliation, type of Judaism that they practice or not. And so when we determine where they are in terms of their skills, their knowledge base, we're able to educate them accordingly.
So do you find that when you have students who are bright but just don't have the same background, that you also have to be careful to help them feel good about the process, that their self-image also matters?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all of us are different. And some students might feel a little less comfortable than others if they're not at the same level with their peers as they're starting the program. So that's a natural element. And we absolutely work closely with them to build their confidence and get their skills in place so that they can feel strong. But also it's part of the culture of the school. And it's having a community and a culture that embraces the individual, no matter where you are as a learner, and just loves you and brings you forward.
Thanks, John. We will talk next week.
You're welcome.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
Temple Emmanuel, pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th of 2016. If you want to go on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe walks into a local bar and sees his friend Moshe sitting there. He puts his hand on his heart and yells out, "Oy vey, Moshe, I'm so sorry to hear about your factory burning down." Moshe spins around and whispers, "Shush, you idiot. It's tomorrow." You see, he burned it down for the insurance. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In a mitzvah that's at the heart of the Jewish religious experience, in our portion of Truma, God commands the Israelites, Asu li mikdash v'shachanti betocham, make me a sanctuary and I will dwell among you. With this statement, the book of Exodus moves from the practical laws to the ritual ones. The plans for the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first site of national worship, and the directions for building the Ark of the Covenant are explained in detail. In order to create the new central shrine for prayer, the place in which God's presence will actually be present, God calls on the people of Israel to donate materials from the best of what they have, what comes to be called a truma offering. A remarkable thing occurs. When the people are asked to donate gifts to build the holy structures to worship God, they come forward immediately and give much more than is required. Moses has to ask the Israelites to stop bringing so much gold and silver and so many precious fabrics. This marks the first and only time in history when a temple building campaign brought in more than was asked for or required. May it happen again sometime soon, perhaps at my temple. In any case, the word for this experience is truma, a freewill offering, a gift to God out of the goodness of the heart. This generous freewill offering is a powerful thing indeed. For when constructed, the tabernacle in the wilderness, built from such free generosity, is immediately filled with God's Shekhinah, God's presence. When we give freely of ourselves to our temples today, in time, love, care, or funds, we seek to recreate that freewill offering, the full gift of heart and hand of our ancestors in Moses' time. And when we succeed in doing so, we too bring God's presence and love into our lives. The great Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai wrote beautifully and sensuously on the subject of the synagogue in his final book, Open, Closed, Open. I studied love in the sanctuary of my childhood. I sang Come, Sabbath Bride on Friday nights with a bridegroom's fervor. I practiced longing for the days of the Messiah. I conducted yearning drills for the days of yore that will not return. The cantor serenades his love out of the depths. Kaddish is recited over lovers who stay together. The male bird dresses up in a blaze of color, and we dress the rolled-up Torah scrolls in silken petticoats and gowns of embroidered velvet, held up by narrow shoulder straps. We kiss them as they are passed around the synagogue, stroking them as they pass, as we pass. From poet Yehuda Amichai, may we find the love of God and holiness in our own sanctuaries today, and may we also give freely from the heart in truma. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the outstanding Rabbi Harold Kushner, will explain what the greatest lessons are that he's learned from life. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us?
The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The long-awaited compromise to create an egalitarian prayer area at the Kotel, the Western Wall in Jerusalem, has finally come about. The Israeli cabinet approved a plan to establish an area at the Davidson Center just south of the traditional prayer area of the Kotel, the Western Wall. It will be about twice the size of the current area that's used for mixed prayer. It will be accessible from the same entrance used for the Kotel in the large plaza, and it will be administered by a group of non-Orthodox religious authorities drawn from the Reform and Conservative movements in Israel. This compromise was originally created by Natan Sharansky. In the compromise, the Women of the Wall, the group that's been holding monthly services at the Kotel Plaza for decades and has been attacked both verbally and at times physically over the years by ultra-Orthodox Haredim, will move its Rosh Chodesh services to the newly designated area. Although it's a compromise, it has to be seen as a major victory for non-Orthodox religious Jewish expression in Israel. It represents a huge improvement on the contentious and problematic status quo at the Kotel. We can all rejoice. The Jews of every denomination now have the right to pray at the holiest site in the world for our people. Two friends of mine have made headlines this Super Bowl Sunday by wagering on their respective towns' teams to win. Rabbi Judy Schindler of Temple Israel in Charlotte, North Carolina, a classmate and study partner of mine at Hebrew Union College, has bet on her town's Carolina Panthers to win, while a skiing friend and past guest of Two Jewish, Rabbi Joe Black of Temple Emmanuel in Denver, has wagered on his city's Denver Broncos to emerge victorious in Super Bowl 50 today. The twist is that the two Reform rabbis have bet not Carolina barbecue or Denver mountain oysters or something, but donations to charities in their respective cities, two-thirds to the winner's city and one-third to the loser's city charities. Rabbi Judy Schindler's made a YouTube video in which she claims that the Panthers' record would be 18-1 if they win, symbolic of the Jewish Chai, and that Panthers quarterback Cam Newton's son is named Chosen, evoking the chosen people. Rabbi Joe Black has not yet responded in video, but since Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning's jersey number is 18, perhaps the Chai argument is muted. So far, the bet has brought in tens of thousands of donations to charity, tzedakah. That might be the best possible result of the Super Bowl altogether.
Testing, testing. 1, 2, 3. Can you all hear me? My name is Rabbi Manny Shevitz, and I am very pleased that you invited me to be with you today, and I've prepared a few words for this important occasion. Today, we celebrate life, a very sacred part of life. I remember when I used to walk down my old neighborhood in Brooklyn. That was before the Dodgers went to Los Angeles, which was the worst thing that ever happened, and I don't know why we let them do that.
That audio was taken from an actual film clip in which Bernie Sanders appeared as Rabbi Manny Shevitz in 1999 in a low-budget indie movie called My Ex-Girlfriend's Wedding Reception. The clip surfaced last week. Bernie Sanders played a rabbi giving a rambling sermonette to the wedding couple that somehow involves bemoaning the Brooklyn Dodgers' move to Los Angeles. Who knew Sanders was an actor? Well, having heard that clip, maybe not. In similarly light Sanders news, Ben Cohen, co-founder with Jerry Greenfield of the exceptional Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, and a Vermonter of long standing, has now made a new flavor to honor the candidacy of Vermont Senator Sanders called Bernie's Yearning. It's mint ice cream with a large disc of chocolate on top, symbolic of the 1% who collect a great deal of our annual national income. It's supposed to be broken up and mixed into the rest of the pint to demonstrate the way that Sanders' neo-socialism will redistribute wealth from the very richest to all of us. Ben & Jerry's founders, like Sanders, of course, are Jewish. Don't expect to find Bernie's Yearning in a grocery store freezer section soon next to Cherry Garcia, however. Ben Cohen only made up a private batch for friends so far. On the other hand, who expected Sanders himself to actually challenge Hillary Clinton for delegates? Perhaps the ice cream flavor will reappear in larger portions later in the campaign. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Harold Kushner. His new book is called Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life, a beautiful and not super long book, along with his 12 other books. Is this your bar mitzvah book? Do I get to say that?
It depends how you count. Every time I look at my bookshelf and count, I get a different number. But yeah, this is number 13.
Mazel tov.
That includes two volumes of my collected sermons, actually.
Oh, well, so there you go. So it depends how you count. He's best known for his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, which has been published in about, 140 languages or something, and has sold millions and millions of copies around the world. One of the really beautiful purveyors of wisdom in our time and maybe for all time. We started talking earlier this morning about the concept of connection to God. And the way that Judaism does that in so many small and subtle ways, kind of pragmatic ways. Mystics see that as actually becoming one with God. Would you view it that way?
That sounds a little bit, I don't want to call it pretentious, but a little bit ambitious. No, I don't think we become one with God. Mystics do. And maybe sometimes I envy them for the experience. I like my way a lot better. Being a companion with God, letting God into my life, providing a dimension of divinity that otherwise would be lacking. I've spent much of my career as a rabbi, and it's going on over 60 years now, trying to wean people away from the idea that God is an all-powerful person who lives in the sky and keeps track of what we're doing. Early in my tenure in Massachusetts, I had a teenager come up to me and said, "You know, I'm about ready to give up on God. There are so many times I've prayed for something, prayed real hard, reminded God of all the good things I've done, and I never got the things I prayed for. What's the point of it?" I said to him, "This God you pray to who disappoints you, he doesn't happen to live at the North Pole, does he? Because he sounds a lot like Santa Claus to me." I think that's a lot of people's idea of God. God is this power who controls everything, and if I do the right thing, and I say the right words, and I give enough charity, and I attend enough services, God will grant my wishes. That's not how the world works. Maybe the major theological point I try and make in the book is that God is not responsible for everything that happens. Do you remember, this must go back a couple of years, there was this great psychological experiment on whether prayer helps people recover from surgery. Sound familiar?
Yeah, I do remember that.
They gather these thousands of post-operative patients matched for severity of illness, divided them in three groups. One group was prayed for and they knew it. One group was prayed for but not told they were. And one group was not prayed for at all. And they wanted to see, would being prayed for and knowing it make any difference at all? Result was none. CNN called me about that. They said, "Rabbi, doesn't that prove that prayer is a waste of time? It doesn't do anything?" I said, "No, of course not. Making sick people healthy is not God's job. That's a doctor's job. Making sick people brave, making sick people strong, that's the doctor's job. That's God's job.
That's
I'm
God's
sorry.
Job, right.
No, God is there to enable us to cope with things that happen to us fairly or unfairly in the world. I'm on a kick now where half of my sermons are trying to remind people that in biblical Judaism, as I read it, God is not a noun. God is a verb. God's name is a verb, really, if you look at it with the knowledge of Hebrew. So it's not the question, who is God or what does God do? It's a question, what are the moments when God is present? I think of the day I learned what it meant to be a rabbi. We got a call at the office. There had been a sudden death in the congregation. A relatively young husband and father who had suddenly died. Rushed down to the house, try and bring some comfort to the grieving widow. All she could say to me was, Rabbi, why would God do this to such a good man? Why would God do this? So at first I tried to explain it, and then after a while I realized that why is God doing this to me is not a question, it's a cry of pain, and what she needed was not a theological answer, but a hug. So I hugged her, and I held her hand, and I sat down with her, and ultimately I was able to lead her to understand that God was not the cause of her husband's sudden death. That was simply biology. He had a congenital heart weakness, and it caught up with him. Where was God? No, when was God? God would be present when she and her children found the strength to go on loving and believing in the world after this tragedy. God would be the one who gives us the strength to cherish her husband's memory. I don't blame God for the fact that our beloved son died when he was 14 years old. I credit God for giving him the strength to live 14 years with a debilitating illness, giving us the strength to love him and comfort him, and give us the strength to go on believing in the goodness of life and the goodness of the world, even after a tragedy. That's when I find God present.
I want to go back to prayer for a moment. Herman Wouk said, the one who rises from prayer a better person, his or her prayer is answered. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that in that it takes off the table the idea that in order for a prayer to be answered, you have to get what you requested.
Right.
That is, you pray for a girlfriend, you don't get a girlfriend, but you get the perception that there are more important things in life. Hmm. You pray for your team to win the Super Bowl, they lose in the playoffs, and you go away saying, well, life goes on and they gave us the good season, it was very excited, I have no complaints. That's where I think prayer makes you a better person. I think we have to get over the idea that prayer is begging. There are languages, including in English, prayer, prego, German, Yiddish, which the verb to pray and the verb to beg are related. I think that is an etymological mistake. To pray is to call on God to give you the strength to live in a world where prayers are not always answered, even if you deserve them.
Now, you talk about the Garden of Eden in your new book. I'm teaching a Genesis project class, and we're about to enter into it. Can you explain how you came to
it? Long enough to get to chapter 3, Sam.
Yeah, I know. Look, we've been doing this now for 3 months or something. They wanted a slow-moving class. I am certainly obliging. Tell us how you came to your own interpretation of Gan Eden.
Reading the Hebrew without prejudice, I had to get over the idea that the traditional Christian understanding and the traditional Talmudic rabbinic Jewish understanding were both forged in the first and second century under the impact of Hellenism. And one of the tenets of Hellenism is that women are unreliable. Think of Homer's Iliad. Two major armies go to war and thousands of people are killed because Helen of Troy can't remain faithful to her husband. Odysseus tries to find his way home after the war. Every time he pulls into a parking space, there are women waiting there to seduce him. Greeks did not value women as being sentient, intelligent beings. The best they could do was carry babies and stay out of the way while men run the world. That's not a Jewish concept. Jewish concepts of women is that women are strong actors. This is Miriam, the sister of Moses. This is Bathsheba. This is all sorts of Ruth. Women are impressive. But that gets lost under this veneer of Greek interpretation. Read the Hebrew without preconceptions, and what you get is a story in which Eve is not the villain. Eve is the first human being. The key is the name of the fruit, which is totally left behind in the traditional understanding. It's not the fruit you're not supposed to eat. It is the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, good and bad. Eve eats it and becomes the first human being in history. She has something that no other living creature has. She shares it with her husband. Together, what does it mean when it says they're naked? You know, we read that chapter 3. Well, of course they're embarrassed that they're naked. Anybody found outdoors without their clothes on would be embarrassed. Until you remember, they are the only people in the world. There is nobody to see them. It's like being self-conscious in your own shower. They're embarrassed to realize that they are subject to evaluation. Unlike any other living creature, they are supposed to know that certain things are wrong. Cheating people is wrong. Stealing is wrong. Lying is wrong. Hurting people is wrong. Lying to people is wrong. These things are wrong in a way that no creature except a human being can understand. This is what we gained when we ate that fruit and left the simple life of the Garden of Eden. I look back at that 1969 celebration in Maxie Esker's farm. What was it called again? The anti-war celebration.
Woodstock, you're talking about.
Woodstock, yes, thank you.
That is certainly the first time I've ever heard Woodstock called the celebration on Max Yasger's farm. But that's true, of course.
Yeah. What I saw it as is a wish to return to the Garden of Eden before Eve ate the fruit. This is paradise. Nothing is wrong. Drinking is not wrong. Taking drugs is not wrong. Nudity is not wrong. Sex with people whose first names you don't know is not wrong. For some idea, this is their idea of paradise. There are no rules. And yet, the story of human civilization begins with the insight that, yeah, some things are wrong. Somebody who takes my property because he covets it is wrong. Somebody who lies to me is wrong. There are concepts of right and wrong. No animal will ever understand that. To me, that is the lesson of Genesis 3. And if you're still you and your class are still talking about this, when I pay my annual visit to Tucson in mid-February,
I expect you
to come in and team teach you with you.
You got a deal. That would be a treat. Let's talk about the concept of mercy, which you also explore, I think, beautifully in your book. You know, the notion of tshuva, return, repentance is very important in Judaism. The notion of forgiveness, a little more complex. Tell us your understanding of forgiveness in Judaism.
I set out my rabbinate believing what I was taught, that as on Yom Kippur we ask God to forgive us for our mistakes, so are we obliged to forgive others for their mistakes. And I got a lot of feedback from that from people who weren't happy, saying what my husband did to me and the kids when he left is not in any way comparable to any things I've done wrong. Why do you want me to forgive him for that? And then I had this insight that I've been misunderstanding forgiveness for all these years. It's not a question of exonerating the other person. It's a question of, you know, she said that this is the divorcee who made the complaint said to me, why should I forgive him? And I said, the only power you have over him now is the power to wash him out of your mind. Stop letting him live rent-free in your head if he no longer lives in your house. We have the power. We can't always wreak revenge. And if we did, we would probably feel compromised by sinking to their level. What we can do is just stop giving them the power to oppress us. This was Nelson Mandela's great moral breakthrough when he was in prison in South Africa. He said, as long as I hate my white captors, I will be their prisoner even after they let me out of my cell. The only way I can reclaim the full measure of my humanity is by forgiving them. not because they deserve it, but because I deserve it, because I deserve not to be oppressed by their defining me as a victim. And I am the only one who can turn off that definition. That's why I write, forgiveness is a favor we do ourselves, not a favor to the people who mistreated us.
I want to thank Rabbi Harold Kushner. I feel like we could go on for hours. His new book is called 9 Essential Things I've Learned About Life, and he will be at Temple Emmanuel, and you'll hear more about that in just a moment. Harold, thank you again for just a tremendous visit.
It's always a pleasure to dialogue with you, Sam, and especially to bring some of the warmth of Tucson into cold, native Massachusetts.
You mean, I think the warmth of your personality could warm up even New England in the winter.
I'll keep trying. Thanks, well, and bless you all.
You too. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our guest today, Rabbi Harold Kushner, author of When Good Things Happen to Bad People, and the new book, 9 Essential Things I've Learned About Life, will be speaking this Saturday night, February 13th at Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson. Call 327-4501 for tickets. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Professor Michael Kagan, a law professor and expert on refugees, discussing the challenge of non-Jewish refugees in Israel. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes as a prayer for peace for Jerusalem, which continues to experience Arab-Palestinian terror attacks. For the sake of Zion, I will not be silent, and for Jerusalem, I will not be still. Laman Sion lo echsheh, laman Yerushalayim lo eshkot. Sung by Hazamir, the International Jewish High School Choir. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good Super Bowl Sunday, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ulema'an Yerushalayim lo eshkot.